looks like crime. Ooh. Yeah. Ooh. Bible by the month.
It's incredible.
Bible by the month.
So mighty.
Bible by the month.
Fantastic.
Bible by the month.
Uncanny.
Well, hello there, and welcome once again to Marvel by the Month, a journey through the history of Marvel Comics. Me? My name is Brian Stratton.
And I am Rob Milne.
Oh, and hey, I'm J.L. Watkins.
Whoa, what are you doing here?
I snuck in for the free beer.
All right, well, cool. We're happy to have you here. J.L. is a buddy of ours, also a giant comics nerd, and I think we're going to talk about some Marvel Comics.
That's what we do.
What are we talking about this week?
We're going to be going to the December 1962, which is newsstand date of October 1962. Fantastic Four number 9, Journey into Mystery number 87, Strange Tales number 103, and Tales to Astonish number 38.
Sounds good. Before we get rolling, should we talk a little bit about what was going on in October of 62?
Yeah.
Cool. Well, a couple pieces of entertainment news. Johnny Carson, ask your parents about him, kids.
I watched The Shining. There's a nice reference.
Yeah, so Johnny Carson took over as the permanent host of The Tonight Show on October 1st. And then a few days later, on October 5th, Dr. No, the very first James Bond film, premiered in the UK.
And my favorite thing that happened this month, the Beatles released their first single, Love Me Do.
Hey, hey.
A little bit of harmonica on there. By John Lennon.
And then in less awesome news, this is when the Cuban Missile Crisis really came to a head. So about halfway through October, the U.S. Had a spy plane go over Cuba, and they saw the missiles that the Soviet Union had smuggled onto the islands and were setting up to be able to basically hit most of the continental U.S. And a lot of very frantic diplomacy ensued, and it kind of culminated with John F. Kennedy going on TV on the 22nd and saying that unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites have been established in Cuba to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere. So if you're a kid in 1962, you're basically thinking that, well, this is probably pretty close to the end.
Right. You're fully clenched all the time.
So all those duck and cover drills suddenly are becoming very, very real. Fortunately, as you may be able to tell by the fact that, you know, the southeastern United States is not a glowing radioactive wasteland. I mean, it's a wasteland in other ways, but it's not a radioactive one. Cooler heads did prevail, and in exchange for removing missiles from Turkey, the Soviets removed their missiles from Cuba. So we live to be terrified yet another day.
And just one note, there were eventually located 42 nuclear missiles at 10 locations in Cuba. So it's not just like initially they saw four, then they confirmed over time 42. That's a lot of nukes.
That's insane. Anyway, we're here to talk about funny books. So before we proceed any further, JL, you want to talk about your bona fides as a comic book guy?
Oh, wow. I have to show my papers.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
I grew up a lifelong nerd. And matter of fact, I'm wearing some Marvel-themed sneakers right now just to
get through
the
cool
door here. No, this is great. I'm still somebody that buys single issues at the comic book store we were just talking about. Backstage, if you will.
Yes.
And but you know what, less Marvel stuff over the years, so it's kind of fun to explore from the other end of the Marvel universe, because when I sort of dropped off several years ago, it was going from one crossover event to another and nothing really mattered, and mm-hmm. everyone's a Skrull and no one's a Skrull and whatever. So
yeah,
it's kind of nice to go back to the basics, yeah, and see what's changed and see what hasn't.
Yeah, I think of the three of us sitting at the table here, I think Rob is the only one of us who actually reads Marvel comics on a regular basis, like the new stuff that comes out.
I continue to read the new stuff, so yeah. I'm up to date as of 6 months ago.
I pick it up at the comic book store and look through it,
mm-hmm.
and then to anyone that'll hear, I'm sort of like, oh. What is happening?
You just smudge the covers a little bit and bend them and then set them back down.
They try to win me back, though. This recently, you know, there's this whole Asgard war going on, but there's like, it's like the team ups. They're like, who can we get together that makes no sense but is completely awesome? So it's like the Punisher, She-Hulk, just a weird band where I'm like, oh, this is right out of my fan fiction.
Right, yeah.
Almost reminds me of like, I reread the Axe of Vengeance stories recently, and that's such an insane crossover where you had like these like A-list villains in the Marvel universe, and they decided they were going to get all their B-list villains to go fight different superheroes, so you had like random folks showing up,
like fight someone else's hero, right? Was that yes. part of the mix-up?
So that was the
like,
whole plan. Yeah. So
throw them off their game.
Yeah, it's always fun when you shuffle the deck like that. But there's very little deck shuffling in this month's worth of comics because
there wasn't quite a deck yet.
There's not really a deck. Yeah, there's like barely a dozen cards. JL, have you read any of these issues before? Do you remember reading any of them, or was this, were you coming in cold on these?
I was coming in cold. So, you know, I've been listening to your podcast, and I love that you go through the history of what's happening at the time and the history of Marvel. And so for this, I'm kind of approaching it as Billy, young boy who just picked up. I usually read westerns and some mysteries, but I decided to pick up Fantastic Four because I'm staying at my grandma's house in Arizona and it's really boring, and so I grabbed these off the rack, and so I'm kind of discovering what the Fantastic Four is.
All right,
I love that you've got Billy's whole backstory here.
You know, actually, that was my backstory. I used to go to my grandma's house in Arizona, and I would like go to the 7-Eleven, and I would go every day just hoping they would refresh it. And I would buy, I didn't care what it was at that point. I would just buy. I needed new stuff.
I had a really similar experience when I would visit my mom's twin sister and her family in New York. They lived out in the sticks on a dairy farm. But we would head into town every few days or so. And there was a little corner store that had a very, very modest rack of comics. And I was like full on into comics at that point. And I think that's how I wound up reading Steel Town Rockers. Huh. If you remember that.
No.
It's like a 6-issue limited series. I think it was an Epic comics series. So it was like Marvel's creator imprint. But it was like basically like straight out of a Bruce Springsteen story. It's like this struggling band of kids who like they put together a rock and roll band. It's going to be their ticket out of this one horse town. And I don't think it ever actually was.
I feel like little Steven like footed the bill for that to get made.
Yeah. It felt entirely like a vanity project, but
yeah, great. I definitely had my share of, you know, whatever Scrooge McDuck comic was there at the time at the market.
Whatever. Near
Campbell. Yeah. Yep. Let's go ahead and dive in. In the interest of sort of getting through the recaps and onto the fun conversation, we're going to sort of just sort of give an overview of what each of these issues was about this month. And then we'll go ahead and talk about the things that stuck out, the things that mattered, and the things that were just totally ridiculous. Let's go ahead. Let's start with Fantastic Four number 9, because, you know, FF, alphabetically and quality wise, is probably at the top of the pile this month. So this is a 5-chapter story, so full length of the book. It begins with the end of the Fantastic Four. On the cover, you see Namor the Submariner just gloating over the Fantastic Four, who are leaving their headquarters with a bunch of suitcases and boxes as a crowd jeers because they've been evicted from their building. They were heroes one minute, bums the next. How did it happen to us? Asks Ben Grimm. Well, we'll tell you. The story starts out with Namor watching on his undersea coral television, learning that the Fantastic Four is declaring bankruptcy because Reed Richards is a genius at everything except investing their money. So Namor does the obvious thing. He buys a movie studio and he offers the Fantastic Four $1 million to star in the movie of their lives. But secretly, he sets up some deadly ambushes for the three male members.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, this is $1,000,000 1962. So
right.
This is the opposite of the Austin Powers joke. It's
like $1 billion.
Yes.
Now.
So what winds up happening is Namor tricks Reed into going to a deserted island where Reed has to fight the mythical Cyclops. Johnny winds up in confronting a warlike native tribe that has a fireproofing potion and something that really maybe doesn't hold up super well by today's standards. And then Ben winds up fighting on the beach with Namor himself. And Namor only wins that fight because Ben winds up getting hit by lightning and turns back into human form.
Which has happened before already. So
yeah.
At what point does it lock in and he just stays Ben Grimm?
I don't know. We haven't gotten there yet. Like, it happens. Now,
almost every issue, he has a brief moment of being human and then is super bummed when he's not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he seems like kind of resigned to it. Like, oh, I'm just human for a minute. Whereas, like, you know, the Ben Grimm I remember growing up is, like, always this existential body horror.
Right.
Yes. Like, yeah. My life, you don't know what I go through every day.
Yeah, yeah. It's still pretty much, it's that.
Yep, yep.
It was written stone from the beginning, pun intended.
But also, recently, I think it was just last month, that he met Alicia Masters, his blind girlfriend, so he's feeling a little bit better about being the Thing these days because she likes him.
He does go and visit her this month too. So yes. So he's it's carried over, and she calls him the White Knight. Mm-hmm. She says he is a good and honorable man, and sends him off with, you know, renewed vigor to help the team and be a hero.
Yes.
So, you know, she's really instrumental in making him a non-villain.
You know, it's funny. We take for granted now that television shows don't do as many callbacks.
Yeah.
You know, everything is very standalone. Even like when Star Trek, you know, started being syndicated, you know, they were really worried that having a story that carried over instead of the monster of the week or the problem of the week. So it is funny to see these little hints now where, like, you know, the girlfriend or Namor has a picture.
Yeah.
Of Sue Storm still sitting there in kind of a creepy way in his office. It's kind of gross.
Yes.
Yeah.
His undersea media room.
Yeah, they're weaving the threads, and that's the way the universe was made. You know, it just everything starts to weave together, and the callbacks are nonstop. So,
yeah,
you know, which does eventually lead to insane crossovers all the time. But,
yeah.
You know, right now it's quaint.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And talking of Sue Storm, so one of the reasons that Namor is not successful in his plan is that when he comes back to her and he says, well, I did it. I took out your brother and your boyfriend and your buddy. And now you can come back to my undersea lair with me and be my queen. And she's not wild about that plan. But the three male members of the Fantastic Four, they show up then and they're ready to just bust Namor wide open. But Sue won't let them gang up on him. She says, look, we held up our part of the bargain. We said we'd make this movie. You got to hold up your end of the bargain, Namor. And to his credit, he does it. Sue shames him into doing the right thing. He produces the movie. The movie winds up being a huge hit, which is probably the most unrealistic part of this entire story.
Sweet, sweet irony.
Yeah. Yes. It's like the first comic book movie, though, I guess. So the bar is pretty low.
Right, exactly. I mean, this is like the first movie of a train coming at the audience was put in theaters, and like everyone ducked out of the way. They're like, we can't believe the special effects are so realistic.
Yeah, so, you know, just like the mechanics of it, is Namor just financing and producing this, or is he actually directing it? Because it seems like the only times they're ever filming the movie is when he takes someone off to beat them up separately from everyone else. Are they recording this?
Yeah, is this a union job?
And at that point, it's a Namor movie.
An SM Studios. Pretty funny.
I assume
he's made other movies, you know, at this point, if he just bought the studio and named it SM Studios.
I think he just bought it for this story, but he hangs on to the studio.
Yeah,
that was something that, like, when I was doing a little bit of further reading, like, Namor doesn't get rid of the studio and it comes back again later on.
Well, what's really great is that the issue opens with Reed Richards, the smartest person in the Marvel universe.
Yes.
He's like one of the top three minds of the Marvel universe, losing all of their money on the stock market.
Yeah.
And also not having some sort of lease or owning the property. So the moment he loses it all, they're being evicted and everyone's taking all their possessions. Like, it's the most monumental screw up for the smartest guy in the world.
Yeah.
But then Namor's got this like portfolio where he owns movie studios and like there's a whole page where he talks about like, you know, taking the treasure and investing in and whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Like his people had tracked all the pirates that buried or hid treasure over the years and he just went and collected it all.
Yeah. I feel like his pitch to Sue could have just been, look at how good I am with money. Look at how bad Reed is. And where do you want to tie your future to?
There was a brief moment, though, where she like has the thought bubble, which I miss thought bubbles. And, you know, she's like, oh, he's so confident, so masterful. Whoa, this is... Where's this guy?
Yeah.
Yep.
And that's Fantastic Four number 9. It's a weird story. It's a fun story.
I love that... Namor is still kind of a dick. I say still. This is the beginning of it.
Yeah,
it's just... And he's a good guy and he's a bad guy, but he's always still sort of like...
Yeah.
Just that dude that you know from high school or college. Where it's like, ha ha! You know, where you're like, ah, oh, Namor.
The guy who will... Like, no matter how old you all get, like, he will hit on your wife every single time. God, he's in the same room.
I don't even know why they have thought bubbles, because it's pretty much anything he's thinking comes right out of his mouth.
That's true.
Imperious Rex!
Rob, you want to take us on a journey into mystery?
Heck yeah, I do. So, Journey into Mystery number 87, a whopping 10-page story featuring the mighty Thor as Prisoner of the Reds. So, guess what? Commies! Which again, you know, we did mention that whole 42 nuclear missiles thing, so it's timely. No pun for that either.
I was gonna say, it's not timely anymore, it's Marvel Comics.
It's marvelous. Yeah. So what happens? There are 5 U.S. scientists that have abandoned their positions and defected to the USSR. But it's a little bit suspicious. So lame Dr. Blake decides that he's going to set himself up to be the 6th. And gets kidnapped by a Soviet agent posing as a photographer. So, and how this works is basically they drug him and then they make him write a note under hypnotism or something cool. And so it's in his own handwriting and then they smuggle him off to the USSR.
And you can tell that it's the USSR because the one panel that shows him arriving is just onion top domes as far as the eye can see.
Yes. So So he gets thrown into a cell. He hangs out with the other scientists in a dungeon, and they all discuss what they're going to do. And he knows. So now he's stuck in a cell. He can't change into Thor. So this is the other thing that always happens for the mighty Thor is he can't. He did get his cane with him, which I thought was lucky.
Right.
But he can't turn into Thor without somebody realizing he's Thor. The whole fun secret identity thing.
Because that's what makes Thor awesome is having a secret identity.
But luckily he gets thrown in solitary. So then he changes into Thor right away. Then as soon as he's alone and he wrecks house on the Russians, but, he allows himself to be kidnapped when their commanding officer threatens to detonate a bomb that would kill the other scientists. So Thor lets himself be captured by the Russians and has 60 seconds without his hammer again. This is always the nail biter. But he manages to escape from the electronically treated chains because he shrinks back down to the lame Dr. Blake. So that's pretty handy being lame sometimes.
And what is an electronically treated chain?
It's like a magnetic ray. Let's just say it's one of the many fun science fiction things that we talk about in these comics.
It's funny how there's things that they have to explain.
Right.
Like, we have to explain what this is, or people aren't going to believe it.
Right.
Like, Namor, he can't just fly like superheroes are accustomed to doing unless there's like a cape or there's wings on his ankles.
Right.
We have to explain this because it would make no sense. But then there's times where it's convenience where there's like, you know, TV underwater.
Right. Right.
Whatever, and you're like, well, this just needs to happen. So let's just this is just so in this issue, matter of fact, like Thor's like swinging a hammer around digging a tunnel. And there's even a thing like, how is this scientifically possible? And they're like, it doesn't matter. Essentially is what they're saying. He's a Norse god. Let's just let it go.
Yeah, don't worry about it, kids.
There's a lot of things. And I'll talk a little bit later about Thor and the trapdoor.
But,
to wrap up the issue, he, of course, trashes the dungeon and rescues the scientists. And then he heads back to the States where Nurse Jane dreams about that dreamy, dreamy hunk Thor. While, you know, Dr. Blake sits there and thinks, man, if I could only tell her I'm Thor, we could get together.
I mean, just so you
I'm
know.
Summarizing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is like 10 pages long, but six of them is just basically her pining for Thor.
Yeah.
And him pining for her.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a 10-page story that feels like it's about 40 or 45, just because it's a lot of dumb things are explained that the explanation is not satisfying. And then a lot of just bizarre things are not explained that definitely needed explanation.
Yeah. So. Which brings me to the trapdoor. I can't let it alone.
Yeah.
This is the second month in a row that Thor or a Thor decoy for Thor has fallen into a trapdoor. I'm like, we got to get something a little less cartoony for this, especially when we know he can twirl his hammer and fly. So, you know, he's not going to be stuck in there. However, he falls into water and messes up some man-eating sharks. So that's interesting in a sort of James Bond way.
Yeah, you know? I guess so. So anyway, yeah, no real villain other than communism.
And all the communists are drawn as like the most ugliest, hideous creature people.
Yes.
Like sometimes you're like, Kirby's got some weird expressions, but you're like, no, these guys are full on mutants. Yeah.
He does that a lot to his villains, and all the commies are villains. So, yeah.
There you go. All right. Well, I'll walk us through Strange Tales 103, a solo story of the Human Torch, who, as you may remember in these, and only in these comics, does he have a secret identity, bizarrely. This one is 13 pages, three pretty quick chapters. It's called The Prisoner of the Fifth Dimension. So it starts out with Johnny Storm. In his hometown of Glenville, he's investigating a mystery in the swamps. There are newly built houses that are sinking into the ground, even though they're being specifically built to prevent that from happening. So Johnny's checking it out. A creepy old farmer comes out of the swamp and blames it on swamp demons. And Johnny decides he's going to stake out the swamp. Later on, that night, he sees the farmer accompanied by two green-skinned spacemen, and they wind up shooting some sort of ray at one of the newly built houses, sink it into the swamp. Johnny confronts them as the Human Torch, at which point the farmer reveals that he's also an alien, and he shoots Johnny with, and I quote, antimatter electrons, which convert ordinary air into a liquid chemical, and that douses his flame. So there you go. There's your science, kids. The alien abducts him into the fifth dimension and brings him before the warlord Zemu, who rules it. Johnny's imprisoned in a giant water tank. He's rescued by a woman named Valeria, who is a member of the resistance and the daughter of the former ruler. Johnny helps them overthrow Zemu by destroying his arsenal and his fireproof giant tank core. People rise up against Zemu. Johnny imprisons him in a cage of fire. The rebels help Johnny return to his home dimension, much to the dismay of Valeria, who is totally down to clown with him. But he's like, I gotta get home to my friends and family.
And his school.
And his school, yeah.
Which is another thing.
So, ladies, if a dude is telling you that he can't hang out with you because he's got to get back to his school, the interest level may not be as high as you're hoping.
Or his dimension. Another flag.
So, yep, pretty straightforward little Human Torch story.
Another set of questionable powers.
Yes.
So at one point he traps some of the guys in a net of fire.
Yeah.
That stays there.
Yes.
Yeah.
So he can control the fire that's not himself.
Yeah,
maybe.
Does he, if he loses concentration, does it go away?
He also makes fire decoys in this issue too. So he's done it throughout the history of the Human Torch, but he makes multiple flaming decoys that look like him. Actually, that happened in the Fantastic Four issue.
You're right.
So he's like a pyromancer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he has really good flaming penmanship.
Right. Also, he writes, skywrites, but it's in flames in the sky.
Yeah.
Not smoke. It's very... I mean, there's quite a bit he can do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing.
Basically anything except stay on fire for more than 5 minutes when the plot demands it.
By the way, reading this issue, yep. they only take one panel to explain why they're sinking the houses, and I somehow skimmed it. So I was like, I don't understand why they're sinking the houses in this stupid swamp. This has nothing to do with anything else. And so I went back. I'm like, oh, okay, it's to keep people from coming to the swamp.
That's where their portal is. Yeah.
I was like, this is just really elaborate weirdness for no reason.
Like I thought it was like this just real estate shenanigans, like any Scooby-Doo plot, you know?
But that's the thing. Some of these stories, they are just weird real estate shenanigans. Like the plot is no deeper than, I don't want them coming around.
Yeah. Okay. It's funny. I was actually going to say this is basically a Scooby-Doo story, but in reverse, where it turns out that the creepy old farmer is a space alien instead of vice versa.
Who pulled the mask off, just like a Scooby-Doo episode.
Also, we need to mention that all of these issues, except for Fantastic Four, were written by Stan's brother, Larry Lieber, with Stan, quote unquote, plotting.
Which is a great, you know, so I got an idea, and then they're like sinking buildings, and so, he goes, and I don't know, something dimension, and it's a tank, he's in a water tank, and I can't wait to see what you got. And you're like, oh my god.
You got 15 minutes, Larry, let's knock this out. Yeah.
Excelsior.
Let's get to Tales to Astonish. So this is a 10-page story. This is what I excel at describing as the 10-page stories. That's also my capacity for attention. So this one is Betrayed by the Ants. The story opens with a bunch of crime bosses who are frustrated by Ant-Man's successful war on crime. So they recruit Egghead, a disgraced scientist who's accused of selling nuclear secrets to foreign agents. Also, his head looks like a giant egg.
Yep.
So, good name.
So he's smart, but also
literally an egg.
Literally has an egg for a head.
So Egghead reads up on ants and designs a device to allow him to communicate with them. He basically reverse engineers how Henry Pym has done this.
I like the fact that there's literally a panel of him reading a book called All About Ants with a giant picture of an ant on it.
I mean, he's out doing research.
Yeah.
I mean, this egghead really is.
He goes out to an anthill. So he's doing, you know, field research. He tries to convince the ants to turn on Ant-Man by appealing to their greed and their vanity.
Yeah. Because ants are legendarily greedy and vain. I also love that as he's doing this, he's sitting on one of those little field stools that's just like,
like a bird watcher stool.
Yeah,
or something.
Yeah, it's like a single pole with like the butt seat, and then like he's got his little headphones and microphone on a pole that he's talking to the ants with. Yeah,
I also love that, you know, like, let's just assume ants have emotions and same motivations as people, and it's not just he's appealing to their better. I'm your friend. I have come to free you from the Ant-Man's rule.
He's really, really getting into some complex ant psychology here,
and the ant. Anthropomorphism. So I couldn't help it.
Oh my god.
Yep. Burn me. Egghead sets up a flypaper trap. So we have another ingenious way to catch Ant-Man. It's usually like there's a hole or there's, you know, we threw him in a waste paper basket and now he's helpless.
Because that's how you get rid of a bug.
So he sets up a flypaper trap for Ant-Man in a museum that is exhibiting the Wentworth necklace. So, Egghead's criminal associates are planning to steal it. So then they leak that information so that Ant-Man heads that way. He beats up all the mobsters and reveals that Egghead misunderstood the psychology of ants. They regard themselves as his friends and his partners in the war against crime. So,
yeah.
Maybe these ants understand more about our life than I thought they did.
Yeah. Maybe the true ants are the friends we made along the way.
So, of course, they let Ant-Man in. They didn't let Egghead know they were, you know, going to actually betray him. And Ant-Man covered his suit with a stick-proof oil and sabotaged the mobsters' escape plans before capturing them with the ants' help. So when they show him covering his suit in oil, they actually show him nude, or at least nude top, you know, from the waist up in a, like a kiddie pool, splashing this stuff on him. And I'm like, well, it could have just put his, you know, costume in there and not jumped in and got himself oiled up, or that maybe that made the costume go on more easily. I don't know. So it's not a clear victory. Egghead escaped to hole up in a dingy Bowery flop house and plan his revenge. And that's how we wrap up Tales to Astonish this month.
Yeah. What was one cool thing about this story, the one cool thing, is it's not an Ant-Man story.
No.
Because he's only told, it's never Pym. There's never any of that stuff. It's all about the villain.
Yeah.
And then only there's a moment where he's like, ha ha ha, you dumbass. This is how I did it. Yeah. And then flashback. And then it goes right back to Egghead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was kind of cool. It's like his introduction.
Yeah. It's a little better than when we had Doom introduced and then you realize that Doom's out after 7 pages and it's just like, you know, the thing in a pirate costume for the rest of the issue, which is fine.
Yeah, I'm not complaining about that.
But the way I remembered it, it was just like Doom all the time. Yeah. So this is really Egghead all the time.
Yeah.
For all 10 pages.
Yeah. Do you guys get into the extra stories that aren't Marvel related?
No, we stay in the hero universe.
I'll sum it up in 10 seconds.
Okay, go for it.
Dude somehow goes a million years in the future and decides to steal a bunch of stuff and frame a bunch of people, and they catch him and send him back. Age 10 years. And you know he's aged because he's got a white streak in his hair.
Oh, there you go.
That'll do it.
So that wraps up our month's worth of comics here. So let's talk a little bit about what mattered this month. Just starting out with Fantastic Four, I think it's always good to see Namor show up in a Fantastic Four story. He's once again sort of the anti-hero with a sense of honor. And the weird, creepy crush on Sue Storm.
And he's a jerk, but he's our jerk.
Yeah, exactly. And he doesn't have noble ambitions, but he still has some nobility to him. So I don't know. I think he's one of the more interesting Marvel characters, especially in the early days. But, you know, even to this day, like Namor is just, he's a classic heel. He's great.
Mm-hmm. I do like how quick Ben Grimm is just to beat people up. I'm not in a good mood. Yeah, I'm gonna pick up 15 people and clobber them.
I guess you could get away with a lot more back then.
I guess so. Yeah. He trashes that cabbie's cab and just like sticks it on a lamppost.
He picks up all the guys on Muscle Beach and throws them into the ocean.
Just beats their asses.
They walk over him. The cab was great too. He does stick that whole cab on the lamppost before firing the flare off. So he is like. You know, as we've said before, Mr. T, like, bit all the rhymes from Ben Grimm. That's where he gets all his lines. It's where he gets all his anger. He just can't quite put a car up on a light post. So the other thing that happens in Fantastic Four is we have superheroes with money trouble. So this is no Bruce Wayne here. This is somebody made a bad mistake on the stock market, as we talked about earlier. Somebody who's one of the biggest brains in this universe.
Yep.
And so now they're evicted and they're on the streets and they have to do some weird stuff for money, which is go star in Namor's movie.
And even after they find out that Namor is financing it, they're still so hard up. They're like, well, I mean, what else are we going to do?
I like the Johnny Storm right away with his cut. He goes and buys a car.
Yes.
You know, because the guy that turns into fire should be driving a gasoline internal combustion engine. It's a really great idea.
Yep.
What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, and kind of, you know, along those lines, another thing that mattered about the month is that it really establishes, you know, in case there's any doubt, that the Marvel Universe is the real universe. So when the FF first shows up in Hollywood, Kirby's got a bunch of cameos by then famous Hollywood celebrities. So you'll see like Alfred Hitchcock's in there, John Wayne, Bob Hope, Dean Martin's in a panel, James Arness, Miss Kitty, Charles Bronson.
Some of them have lines even.
No, Kirby, he went nuts with it and had a lot of fun with it. But yeah, if there was any doubt, those doubts are erased. This is the here and now. This is
they exist in New York. Yep. They go to LA, they see the existing popular movie stars of the time and directors and or at least enough for Hitchcock's.
Okay. Yep. Yep. And the FF, definitely by the end of the issue, they are cemented as like the biggest superstars in this world. They have a hit movie, which again is totally the most unrealistic thing to happen in this entire issue, considering how the FF have fared in our world in movies. They are at a giant premiere. They're being mobbed by fans. Like, they're legit celebrities.
Yeah, they're probably why the Beatles put out movies.
Yes, exactly.
If you want to have FF mania.
Yeah, I mean, if there's a fabulous foursome, you know, who are famous for doing other things, then maybe we can make movies too.
And we also get Zemu, ruler of the fifth dimension. So maybe not as big of a deal, but no. He does show up and exists in the universe going forward with, as we've said earlier, various spellings of his name.
Yes.
Zemu, Z-E-M-U, Zemu, X-E-M-U.
Yeah, and he's not to be confused with Zemo, the Captain America villain or villains.
The Baron, yeah.
Yep, or Zemnu, who's a Hulk villain, or Xenu from Scientology. And then in the Ant-Man story, Egghead is introduced, and he winds up being Hank Pym's honest-to-God nemesis. He shows up again and again. And really, like, by the time the 70s roll around, like, he is just absolutely messing with Hank Pym, like, badly. He winds up completely destroying Hank Pym's life. So this is where it all begins. And you have to wonder if Ant-Man had just let him steal the damn necklace, then maybe he could have saved himself a lot of grief later on. But he had to get smart and outsmart him with ant psychology, and well,
so, you know, stick around for whatever 140 episodes of this podcast and you'll find out what happens.
Yeah. Ooh. How's that for a tease?
That's the lamest tease ever. I can't help but read all of these comics with like weird 60s TV movie voices in my head.
Yeah.
So we're like,
yeah,
hey, Fantastic Four, you thought you fooled me, but you didn't get me, see? That's, I just can't get it out of my head. You know, it's really funny because you guys are going through the history of the Marvel Universe. Mm-hmm. And like, I think about like weird stuff that my grandpa would have done. Like,
yeah,
you know, the popcorn trick where you go to the theater and you put a whole mug of popcorn. And you know, the lady likes you. You know, those are the kind of weird 60s things I'm thinking of. And you guys are like, oh, Bay of Pigs and the Skrulls are really communist. Yeah. And I'm like,
and also JL's pervert grandpa.
Right, right. I mean, this is, I guess this is where I get it from. I mean, every time Ben Grimm turns back, you know he's touching himself.
He's like, finally.
The panel ends. And off panel, he's like, I got 5 solid minutes. That's all I need. I do like that Namor got a majestic send-off.
Yes.
As he walked back into the sea. The monarch returned $1 million
later. Yeah.
Which is a wave of the hand to him.
Yes. Yeah. He's got all the treasure of the seas.
What else happened? Well, Thor fought some commies again. I guess, you know, given what was going on in the world, that was probably pretty satisfying at this point to see Thor knocking some Soviets around. But it really didn't do anything to further the character, or there's no Asgardian stuff. So, like, none of the mythos got expanded. None of these guys shows up again. Yeah.
I mean, it is a chore, like, right now, kind of, because you know, like, the Thor that you're used to is, like, eventually later realizes, you know, I'm Thor Odinson, and I don't have to change back and forth, and whatever, you know, all of this secret identity, and...
And it gets cosmic.
Who doesn't give a crap about being a doctor?
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Let's talk about all the malpractice. That would be a good issue. You know, with everything that was going on at the time, we got some failed real estate and some weird...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Two real estate-related stories and a whole bunch of other weird stuff, and only one commie-busted story.
I think they had, like, you know, the 60s equivalent of a post-it note for which one is going to cover commies, right, or which two. You know, sometimes there's more than one commie.
Well, I was
going to
say, I think a couple, 3 weeks ago, we did an episode where...
The Hulk's always dealing with commies.
Yeah, I think like 3 of the 4 issues we read, commies were the villains in every single one of them. So it was like Fantastic Four fought an actual supervillain, and then it was just commies, 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 which is Motley Crue's least successful single. But but speaking of workers of the world uniting, this is also the first month that creative teams are officially credited in the books. So that was not the norm in comics at the time. Sometimes you'd have, you know, artists being allowed to sign their work, or sometimes you get a mention of the writer's name, but the writer, penciler, inker, and letterer were actually all credited in all of these issues. And for all of them, it was Jack Kirby doing pencils on everything. Dick Ayers was inking him, and Stan Lee wrote Fantastic Four and plotted the rest of them, and Larry Lieber scripted the 3 non-FF comics. So
it's a pretty big month for Larry. That's like, you know,
yeah, it's big time.
Like 40 pages.
Yeah, but
well, you know, maybe 34. I think right. It's probably more accurate.
But yeah, this is the start of Marvel at Stan Lee's urging or direction, establishing a more personal connection with the readers. And that's something that like Marvel really jumps into whole hog. Stan designs this whole character around Stan the Man Lee, and he's got Stan's soapbox, and you know, he makes the readers feel like they're a part of this wacky family. So this is sort of the first inkling of that.
This brings us to our panel of the month. I was torn because, as I mentioned with that trapdoor in Thor, I really thought it was so hilarious that he fell into a trapdoor again that I wanted that to be it, but I tried to think of something more positive. So I thought, what would Stan want? And I really focused in on Strange Tales number 103, page 6, panel 5, which is where we unveil Kirby's fifth dimension. Mm-hmm. So that's where we see, much like we saw the future, the 2300s, I think, in the last Mighty Thor, we see a different weirdness, which is what we see in the fifth dimension. So there are, just in that one panel, a lot of cool, weird things. The second panel after that, we see this elaborate floating off balance throne as well. So it's like, I can't even describe it, which is again, how weird some of these things that come from Kirby are. But this scene of the fifth dimension world, we have buildings shaped like streamlined coffee makers and arches going through the air and some kind of, you see floating car things that make no sense at all. And they all look just beautiful and they all fit in this world. And that's just like one snapshot from, and a couple panels from the old swamp that we were dealing with. And again, just how versatile and inventive Kirby is.
Yeah.
So, so that, I mean, the comic itself isn't that great, but this idea and this, you know, getting to see him do these things is always wondrous.
Yeah, absolutely.
How about you?
I'm going exactly the opposite direction. Something really, really mundane. So I'm going to go to Fantastic Four, number 9, on the fifth page, on the last panel, panel 7. Fantastic Four, they've gone bankrupt. They've gotten the offer to make the movie of their lives. They're all set to go to Hollywood. Then they realize they don't really know how they're going to get to Hollywood because they have no money and no vehicle. So it's a shot of the Fantastic Four hitchhiking to Hollywood. So Reed and Sue and Johnny are standing by the side of the road with their suitcases and their thumbs out. And Ben is hiding in the trees. So he says, "I'll stay out of sight back here so I don't scare anyone away." And Reed's like, "Hey, don't be embarrassed. We'll all laugh about this one day." And Sue responds, "I hope so." So, yeah, probably maybe still not super happy with Reed for losing literally every dollar that they have.
See, rocket jumping plane and the air powered Fantastic Car.
Do they buy it all back? Like the next issue? Like how do they?
Well, they're going to have $1 million, man. I mean,
yeah, of course.
Like, yeah, the rocket, the flying car. I don't know why they just didn't keep the flying car. It's so weird.
I don't know. Maybe, you know, between this and the next issue, you know, maybe Reed develops a system and goes to Vegas and just, you know, just breaks every bank.
Much better than stocks for Reed Richards. And, you know, he has a lot of ideas. He has patents and inventions out there. So he's got money that's coming in, maybe just waiting on a check. Probably tens of thousands of dollars in patents a year.
Wow.
All right, JL, what do you got?
Oh, well, I had two favorite panels, and they're both just weird little moments. They're nothing like super fantastic. The very first panel in the Fantastic Four, where Namor's got the picture of Sue Storm, and he's watching his coral television, and he's just talking to himself.
Yep.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
As megalomaniacal undersea rulers will do.
I must defeat them. What shall I do? You know, just walking around. So that's great. Then I also like in the Johnny Storm story, there's just this one fun panel where he picks up the space woman.
Yes.
Flies along with her, and she just goes, "Oh, you're wonderful." And he's just like, "I don't care. I have no time for this business." But it's just such a nice little, like, I can hear her voice, like, "Oh, you're just wonderful."
We've come to the end of our podcast, where the only thing left is to decide how marvelous we thought the month was. This month, the rating scale that we're going to use, we're going to compare this month of Marvel Comics to one of the Fantastic Four movies since.
The real movies, not yes. the one that did really well in this comic.
Right. This month. Not that imaginary Fantastic Four movie that was a huge success, but the four that actually existed in the world. So, just to refresh everyone's memories, there were four Fantastic Four movies. There was one released in 1994 that was made by Roger Corman, that was extraordinarily low budget, and was actually never theatrically released. It was just made so that the rights wouldn't expire. so there's that. There's the 2005 Fantastic Four movie, which starred Chris Evans, who would later become Captain America, and Jessica Alba and Michael Chiklis. There was a 2007 sequel to that one, The Rise of the Silver Surfer, which is based on Warren Ellis's Ultimate Galactus story. And then the one that I don't think anyone remembers is the 2015 movie, which is a reboot of the Fantastic Four, just called Fantastic Four again. But that one did star Michael B. Jordan as the Human Torch, and he would later go on to be Killmonger in the Black Panther movie. So
I forgot there were four movies.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know why I've seen all of them, and I forgot there were four, but...
Yep.
Man, that movie had so many moments where it could have been good, yeah. and then they're yeah. just like, let's make it bad instead.
Yeah.
We have like this amazing cast, but let's do something dumb.
Yeah.
Yeah. So whatever. Yeah.
Yep.
I guess it's been litigated in the box office.
So. Yeah. Yeah. So, but yeah, so each one, starting with the 2005 film, basically got progressively worse reviews and made less money as it went. So to give you a sense of the scale, so probably 05 would be at the top, but still not at the top.
Yeah.
And then 07, 15, and then probably 1994 would be at the very bottom, since that was actually made kind of as a joke. Yeah. So where do you put this, Rob?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it seems like they're all bad. Mm. So there's no way to rate this month.
Yeah, we have to rank those before we rank.
Yeah, as anything but unmarvelous.
Yeah,
which it's not a great month from some of the things we've seen, but we do have Namor and some mm-hmm. hilarious things.
Well, if you want to rate it, there, I think there actually is a really good Fantastic Four movie out there, and I think it's called The Incredibles.
That's yeah. true. That is... So, I'm not going to give it an Incredibles rating by no. any means. I think if I could take moments and actors from each of those movies and put them together,
mm-hmm.
And then just throw darts at a wall in the dark, I can probably put together a great script for the next one, which would be slightly better than all of these right. and where I would rate this month.
All right.
So just a little better than all of those movies in a perfect combination.
Okay.
Yeah. So how about that for complicated?
All right. That's super complicated. Jail, what do you got here?
You know, the stories weren't the most amazing stories, but it wasn't. I had really low expectations because, like I said, I expected, like, hey, we're going to go have a contest. Who can eat the most hot dogs? I'll show you up, Reed Richards, and take away Sue Storm. I guess the stakes in some of these stories are so. So I was kind of like, oh, it's going to, you know. That's what's going to happen. So it was entertaining. You know, it's fun to see these like little grace notes throughout the thing that kind of, you know, becomes the Marvel Universe later. But yeah, you got to have me back on a better, definitely a better
one. We will. Cool. I'm actually going to rate this. I'm going to go with a 1994 movie, the Roger Corman movie. Not because I think this is the worst month of comics that we've ever read, but because at least like that one, it's like the definition of a good bad movie. Like if you are familiar with the characters, going and watching that piece of trash is just so much fun. It just right down to the very last scene where like Reed and Sue get married and they're driving away in a limousine and there's this giant fake rubber arm waving out of the sunroof.
Yeah.
It's so bad. It's good. And so I think like,
that's kind of what this month is. You're right.
Yeah. You know? And also the fact that, you know, Fantastic Four number 9 was film that they were paid $1 million to make that movie. And I believe that
that was the budget.
The Roger Corman movie had like about $1 million to work with.
Or so, less. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think just thematically, I think it all ties together. So that's where I'm going to put it. Not because it's terrible, but because it was so bad that there was a lot of fun.
Billy really enjoyed the comics that he picked up in the store. You know, gee, mister, maybe I'll try it again next time.
All that remains is to tell folks where they can find us on the internet. JL, if someone wants to harass you on the internet, how can they do that?
Oh, fantastic. I cannot stop saying fantastic. It is so like the curse of reading this comic. You know, I'm all over the internet, so I go by Little Lust Robot on Twitter and all the other places. It's a blog I've had like for 20 years now.
I can vouch
for this. I'm really bad at WordPress, though, so every couple of years I lose everything.
Yeah.
Your
theme fails.
So I have them all collected, and I get GoDaddy notices in my, you know, it's like, your files are messed up. But anyway, so maybe by the time you read this, I've gone to the blog and cleaned it up.
Nice. But, as for us, you can find us at marvelbythemonth.com. You can hit us up on Instagram. Honestly, Instagram is where I think we put most of the effort for our social presence. At marvelbythemonth. But also, you know, check us out on Facebook if it hasn't been shut down and broken up by the government by the time you read this. Facebook.com/marvelbythemonth. Or what the hell? Twitter, @marvelbtm. So, yeah, thanks again for tuning into our 10th episode.
Wow.
This is pretty exciting. We're in double digits
now. Where are the balloons, man? I thought you were going to drop balloons.
Oh, no, we don't get those until 100. Oh. We'll have a star-studded spectacular.
I am wearing a tuxedo.
Yeah,
that's true. Yeah.
And it's very
Since warm. We're on a podcast, I'm wearing a tuxedo. It's really awesome.
Yeah, it's been awkward. I'm glad you brought that up because it was a little awkward. I wasn't sure how we're going to work that in. JL was very excited to do this tonight, I guess. So, but yeah, thanks for listening. I remain Brian Stratton.
And I still am Rob Mill.
And we will see you next week for next month.